Morning, everyone. We're still pretty new to the fact that I'm there going, maybe we should go to the newcomers' morning tea in a couple of weeks. I thought I'd let you know how we ended up here, because some people are here going, oh, it's a guest speaker, which is lovely, but we call this place home now, and so I thought I'd let you know how we got here. So we first attended here, I went back through the Facebook group, August 6 last year, seeking a church that we could attend as a family after moving down from Western Sydney in May. We did the church shopping for a little while and we landed here. And Mark Huggins was preaching, but in our house we call him Huggo. I don't know if anyone else does, but it's fun. And my main memory was thinking that, wow, they have actual coffee after church. This is good. We then came back because Scott Darlow was preaching the following week, and I'd known Scott through my previous job. And I said to him, oh, we should go back and say hello. So after 2 weeks in a row, we realized that we hadn't heard Paul preach. He'd been on annual leave. And we thought, oh, well, we'll go back again. And Paul did preach that week. But also we realized that my daughter Harper knew Bridget from school. So suddenly she wanted to come back. And we'd been here 3 weeks in a row. And we figured, well, this was our church now. That's how we make decisions in our house, you know. If your daughter says, can we go to church? You're like, yes, we can. My kids, Patrick and Harper, both attend Gisborne Primary. And my wife, Mel, works there now. And so just over a year after moving to Gisborne, we realised that we're pretty settled here. And in about 25 years' time, people will think of us as locals. So we're well on the way. But a bit more context is, which Naomi alluded to. I've been a pastor in the Uniting Church for about 10 years now. I started training straight out of high school as a special needs primary teacher. I started working at my local church where I'd grown up part-time. No, I grew up full-time, but I started working there part-time. And after about 5 years of that gig, we moved to Sydney's Northern Beaches, where I became a pastor at Balgowlah Uniting Church. Now, no one really knows where Balgowlah is other than to say it's the hill before Manly Beach. So if you've ever driven to Manly Beach, you've driven through Balgowlah. And after a few great years there, I was invited to work for the New South Wales ACT Uniting Church as their next gen consultant, resourcing ministries with children, young people and campus ministries. That was great fun. And after 6 years in that role, while still having a strong sense to the type of ministry I was in, we decided it was time to move. And so we had the opportunity to come and pick up the job I have now in Melbourne, and we found Gisborne our home. That's probably enough about me. We can have coffee after. But a few months ago, Paul invited me to consider preaching, and he's either very trusting or he's decided he might need plausible deniability by the fact that he's not here. So any positive feedback, go to Paul. Any complaints, do not tell Paul. And hopefully we've come here not to hear about me, but to hear what God might be saying to all of us through the scriptures this morning. So we're going to jump in. At the heart of one of the traditional Christian understandings of Jesus is this deceptively simple yet profound, provocative and frequently misunderstood statement. Jesus was fully God, God incarnate. And when I say it's frequently misunderstood, what I mean is this: I think we hear it the wrong way around. That is, we try to take what we think of God, whether it be those Greek philosophical categories of divinity, omnipotent, omniscience, that one where you're everywhere, or the rest. Or maybe the Hebrew revelations of divinity, holiness and unity and so on, and we try and apply them to Jesus. And frankly, we get in a mess before we even begin, because we have to start by acknowledging that not every characteristic of God fits into Jesus. Omnipresence, for example. And then we start wondering whether Jesus had, for instance, unlimited divine power as a baby or a toddler. And that is a terrifying thought if you've had young children in your house. In fact, some of the apocryphal stories of Jesus... of Jesus' childhood, there are cameos where Jesus as a child makes clay pigeons and then breathes life into them. And yet those stories seem kind of weird when we hear them. But wouldn't a child who was also God do cool stuff like that? Like, I've read Harry Potter. You would. You'd... No fans? One fan. Okay, good. Well, I'm still learning. I'm still new. I told you that. But I want to suggest that the Christian belief of Jesus as God doesn't work that way around. Instead of saying Jesus is in every way like God, I think what we need to hear is God is in every way like Jesus. Anything we think we know about God, whether we think of it from instinct or tradition or reason or the Bible, we need to hold up against the revelation of God that is Jesus. His life, his teaching, and most of all, his character. I read recently, if your reading of the scriptures do not lead you to the conclusion that you should love all people, you're simply reading it wrong. Today we're going to, I want to read to you a short passage from John chapter 6. John chapter 6, picking it up at verse 14. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they began to say, "This is indeed the prophet who has come into the world." When Jesus realized that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he withdrew again to the mountain by himself. When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, went across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the water and coming near the boat, and they were terrified. But he said to them, "It is I, do not be afraid." Then they wanted to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the land toward which they were going. This reading in John's Gospel follows directly after the feeding of the 5,000. We're familiar with that story. Hill, people everywhere, not enough food. Now, in my very unscientific survey of all the sermons ever said about the feeding of the 5,000, I'm going to estimate that about half of all preachers look at it as a miracle of provision, where God multiplies the food to make sure that everyone has enough. And about, well, the other half of all preachers speak of the miracle of generosity, that Jesus, through the generosity of a child, enables all those present to share what they have, so that all are fed. I probably tend towards the second reading myself, but I might add one small observation to that story. In the Synoptic Gospels, telling of the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus has the people sit down in 50s and hundreds. If the story here is really about the miracle of sharing, we need to notice the brilliance of that simple act. That in a huge crowd, overwhelmed by need, everyone holds tightly to what they have. No one shares in a crowd of 5,000. But in these smaller groups, where we can look at everyone and see them as people, our instinct to share overcomes our fear of scarcity, and we can give. Unfortunately, the media and our politicians know this truth as well, that we can be persuaded to fear or reject these ill-defined crowds, whether they be Muslims or asylum seekers or the African gangs, in a way that breaks down when we realize that these people are our friends, our neighbors, people just like us. So when gathered as 50 or 100, just as we are here today, we can feel a connection with one another that we don't have in these large crowds. We are ultimately designed to live as a village, not a city. Now, in my first draft, I actually wrote that we are village people, but I caught it early, so we can dodge that one. But whatever the process that took place at this feeding of the 5,000, there can be surely no doubt that it was a picture of God at work. Jesus responding to the need of those around him, those who reached out to him to seek his help. The psalmist writes, God is near to all who call on God. And where we pick it up in John chapter 6, today's story is another example of the same. The disciples head across the lake towards Capernaum. Jesus is not with them, and we're going to come back to that in a moment. And they find themselves getting nowhere. The wind is against them. The sea is rough. And when they see Jesus walking on the water, they are terrified. But he comes to them. He calms their fears and brings them safely to the other side. Now you'll notice that, well, for those playing along at home, that John's telling of this story leaves out the whole Peter walking out to Jesus bit. Perhaps because I don't think John is trying to tell us something about the nature of faith. It seems as if John has a couple of messages here in his story today. The first and most obvious, I think, is this. When the disciples got into trouble, when they weren't going anywhere, Jesus came to them and he helped them. The second, perhaps a little more pointed, was this. The disciples went on ahead without waiting for Jesus. And when they did that, they found themselves getting nowhere. Only was when he was with them again did they start to make progress. And I think these are both great messages. I think these are both true for us today. But I want to reflect for a moment on what's almost treated as a throwaway line in the middle of this passage, the reason Jesus was not there with them. I think it's verse 15 says that when Jesus realized that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he withdrew again to the mountain by himself. Jesus was near to the people who needed food in the feeding of the 5,000. He came near to the disciples in the boat when they were afraid. God is near to all who call on God. But when they came to make Jesus king, he was nowhere to be found. The reason the disciples found themselves as evening fell, needing to travel alone, was just this. Jesus had withdrawn because they, and I don't know who they are. Was it the crowds? Was it disciples? Was it everyone? They wanted to take Jesus and make him king by force. And again, this is kind of ambiguous in the text. Did they want to make him king by force? Or did they just want to take him by force to make him king? We're not quite sure, but Jesus had removed himself. God was near to those in need, but when those same people tried to reshape Jesus into their desires, to use him to advance their own ends, he was nowhere to be found. And it made me wonder, how often are we guilty of that? How often are we fundamentally missing the point? If it is true that all we need to know of God we can see in Jesus, then God is there for those who are in need, there for those who cry out to God, there for those who are afraid and getting nowhere, but absent to those who would take hold of God and use God to advance their own causes. The people tried to take Jesus as if they owned him, as if he was theirs to use to gain the political freedom they so desired, and he would have none of it. I wonder if the church is just as guilty of treating Jesus as if we owned him, as if he was ours to roll out, to seek to use God as if God were our property, as if we had the right to decide what God would do, to seek by force to put God where we think God should be, and to forget the fact that Jesus point blank refused to be made king. Now, this is not to say that we should not allow our faith to shape what we believe in, the causes we will fight for, the values we will hold. Of course we do, and of course we must. We have every right, for instance, to say that because I am a follower of Jesus And because I believe that Jesus stood up for those who are oppressed in society, I will speak up for those who have no voice. I will fight for those who cannot fight for themselves. But when we hear ourselves or our fellow believers saying, this is God, what God would do, this is what God thinks, I fear perhaps we've crossed a line. Especially when such pronouncements seek to take us further from the gospel of God's unconditional love. We do not own God. We seek to follow him, but God is not ours. Amen. I'm going to pray, and then I think Fiona's going to come up. God, we trust and we are comforted in the promise that you draw near to those who need you. And so this morning, God, we simply ask that you would help us understand. Help us be reminded not to seek to turn you into our own motivation, but simply that in Jesus we have seen you. That we would be guided by Jesus as God. That when we call to you, you respond. Amen.